WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And with me back for a return visit to Fresh Air is film writer and director Garson Kanin, who is now also known for his books, which include Moviola, the bestseller on which the popular made-for-TV movie was based. Kanin is married to actress Ruth Gordon, with whom he's collaborated on a few projects, including the screenplays for Pat and Mike and Adam's Rib. Perhaps it's because of their success as a team that he's written a new book called Together Again, the stories of great Hollywood teams, including Katherine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, who Kanin helped bring together on the screen, Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh, Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, Rock Hudson and Doris Day, Woody Allen and Diane Keaton, and Laurel and Hardy. Garson Kanin has too many credits to list for you, so I'll just refresh your memory on some of his Hollywood credits. He wrote The Playborn Yesterday and the screenplays with Ruth Gordon for Pat and Mike, Adam's Rib, A Double Life, and The Marrying Kind. He directed My Favorite Wife and Tom, Dick, and Harry. He's directed stage productions of Hitch Your Wagon, Born Yesterday, The Diary of Anne Frank, Do Re Mi, and Funny Girl. Garson Kanin, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure
Carrie.
To see you
nice
again.
Nice to see you again. We're together again, as you say.
Is it your personal teaming up that led to this book?
Oh, no. No, the idea, Terry, of what makes a team has long intrigued me. And in the old Hollywood days when you had major studios and they had a lot of players under contract, they were constantly looking for combinations that would work. Some of them turned out to be quite unlikely, as at Metro they found that if they put Marie Dressler and Polly Moran in a picture together, they could sell it easily, and so they made 9 or 10 of those Marie Dressler, Polly Moran pictures. And some teams were manufactured, some happened quite accidentally, some were simply forced, such as William Powell and Myrna Loy. Nobody thought that was a team. Myrna Loy played rather exotic parts, mainly, and William Powell was the ultimate sophisticate. And when they were going to make The Thin Man, they couldn't get a leading lady, and they tested several, and one day Bill Powell said, why don't we try Myrna Loy? And they said, Myrna Loy? But she's famous for saying that line, the gypsies, they teach me to walk so as never to crush a flower. And Bill Powell said, yeah, but I know her. I know her personally. I know her off screen, and I think she could do it. And so they took a chance, and one of the great teams of all time was born. They just went on making picture after picture. And so it's still unexplained as far as I'm concerned. I don't know why two personalities will all at once seem absolutely made for each other and work and bring out the best in one another. And in other cases, it's quite flat. So I began to study all the different teams and run their pictures, and I selected the 20 teams that we have in Together Again with about 500 pictures and a lot of text. And I keep exploring in each team just what made them a team.
Was there more interest on the part of directors and the studio, say, in the 30s and 40s in creating teams that could endure from movie to movie than there is now?
I expect so, although Woody Allen, who is a preeminent filmmaker of our time, certainly believes in the team idea, because once he got going with Diane Keaton, they made a whole series, as you know, of films, and each one got richer and deeper and better and perfectly marvelous. I was distressed to see that team break up, but now he's doing a movie with Mia Farrow, and I'm told that he's planning still another movie with Mia Farrow, so perhaps that will be a second team with Woody Allen. It depends on the director. For example, abroad, we have Sophia Loren and Marcello Mastroianni, who've now made 9 films together, 10, really. There's one that isn't even in the book. Since the book came out, they made another picture. They were more or less created by Vittorio De Sica, who put them together first. They love working together. Sophia told me she'd do anything with Marcello without reading the script because she just loves working with him. I think that's true about most of the teams. Most of the teams in this book, Together Again, I think were people who genuinely liked each other, admired each other, and respected each other, And that's why they were able to work together as a team.
You had you played some part in bringing together Tracy and Hepburn.
Yeah,
How did that come about?
It was just that I knew Spencer Tracy very well, and I knew Kate Hepburn. And in a fantasy kind of way, I thought, wouldn't it be terrific if they were in a film together? Neither one of them took to the idea at first, but my brother Michael and Ring Lardner Jr. and I got together and we wrote an original screenplay called Woman of the Year. And when it was shown to Spencer on the one hand and Kate on the other, they both saw the possibilities of themselves as a team. And, of course, it worked perfectly from the start. From the first day, everybody simply knew that they were going to be a great team.
I've always tried to figure out why that's so, why they were a great team, because, as you point out in the book, Spencer Tracy is one of the few leading men who isn't really handsome. You know, he's just not the kind of face or body that leading men are traditionally made out of.
Yeah. Well, at one time, you couldn't have a leading man unless he looked like Robert Taylor or Frederick March or Ronald Coleman or John Gilbert. Those were the days when films were far more dreams than they are now. There began to come a time when films began to deal not only with fairy tales, but with people, with real things happening to real people. Therefore, it wasn't necessary to be a Greek god to be a leading man. And we began to see Spencer Tracy, a little bit later, Humphrey Bogart. Sometime after that came Walter Matthau, Steve McQueen, Dustin Hoffman. Rather unlikely leading men, but they did indeed become leading men and stars. I think all to the good, too. It was rather boring, to tell you the truth, to just keep looking at these Arrow shirt collar ads come to life on the screen one after the other. But today, I don't think that obtains. Although, here you have Robert Redford, Warren Beatty, Paul Newman, who represent the old school of leading men, excessively handsome fellows, and there's room for them, too. What I admire and appreciate more than anything is the diversification.
Well, you said that Fred Astaire almost wasn't cast in any films because they thought he was balding and his ears were pointy or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, yes.
Chin too prominent?
Yes, and they thought they just thought he was quite funny looking, that's all. And the report on him said he probably couldn't be photographed, but even though he could dance a little, they said in the report. Fortunately, there are no rules. The basic rule is talent. I don't think anyone ever gets to be a real star without talent, no matter how they look. There has never been on the screen a more beautiful woman than Hedy Lamarr. She was breathtakingly beautiful. Alas, she simply did not have sufficient talent for acting to bring her the rest of the way. She, of course, was successful in her day and was a Metro star, but she never really made it over the top in the way that, say, Greta Garbo, who is perhaps the most beautiful woman who ever was on the screen, but she had immense talent for acting, complete talent for acting, and that helped.
You've known many great leading men and women on and off the screen. Do you find that a lot of times people who are just really spellbinding on the screen are kind of ordinary off the screen, and that it takes the way the camera looks at them or just that larger-than-life imagery to create that specialness?
Yes, I think that's true in some cases, and some of them are just as enchanting off the screen as they are on. Greta Garbo happens to be one of them. Laurence Olivier is another. On the other hand, Gary Cooper, who was an enormously effective player on the screen, was rather flat, if you knew him in real life. He was really yup and nope off the screen as much as he was on. So again, we're dealing with something for which there are no particular rules, with highly individual. But in Together Again, there aren't only the man-woman teams, but the essence of a team, for example, works with Laurel and Hardy, perhaps the most enduring comedic team ever developed by the film medium. I simply adore them, almost everything they do. They made 104 pictures together. I've seen every single one. And they never fail to enchant me, you know, no matter how often I see them. They too developed a kind of interplay and brought out the best in one another. Think how different that teaming is from, say, Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy. It's true that Jeanette MacDonald made some other pictures, but you always think of her in connection with Nelson Eddy. That was a very real and important teaming.
I'm talking with Garson Kanin, if you're just joining us, and we're discussing his new book, which is called Together Again, which is about great Hollywood teams. I think the big surprise for me of your book was reading your appreciation of Doris Day and Rock Hudson. And I was frankly very surprised that you'd gone back and looked at their films and thought that they had terrific chemistry and that the films would really endure.
Well, I know that it's it's quite fashionable to look upon them as rather campy now. But if you look at those films, you see that they had very real comedic quality. And he is an enormously attractive leading man. And she was attractive and appealing and very, very American. I think that's what their appeal was, that they were idealized Americans. They so different, say, from Olivier and Lee or even Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers don't seem all that American, you know?
Well, is it American or suburban that
you're
thinking
of? Yeah, that's right. Yes, that's true. It was really middle-class America or even a little cut below that. And they were so clean and so shiny and so antiseptic and so gee whiz that they became terribly appealing. And they worked wonderfully together. I've seen him many times before and since, and Doris Day too, but they were never as good as they were together somehow, and that's the answer to the teaming.
You don't think that the teaming of Doris Day and Cary Grant and That Touch of Mink equals the teaming of Day and Hudson in their films together?
That's a very good question, Terry, and the answer is this. I don't think anyone in the world would dispute me, including Rock Hudson, when I say that Cary Grant was probably as fine a light comedian ever developed by the American film. Rock would claim no such distinction for himself. But it is perfectly true that Cary Grant did not partner Doris Day as well as Rock Hudson. They seemed to be made of different material somehow. They just weren't of the same cloth, as one would say. And she seemed to be a little bit intimidated by him in That Touch of Mink. And obviously, it didn't work very well, because had it worked, they'd have gone on and made some more pictures together. But there didn't seem to be any crying demand to see those two together again.
When teams like that make it on the screen, they become the great love interests in the country. And that's always been equated with heterosexual love interests in the country. And every so often you hear rumors about so-and-so, who is this great heterosexual star on the screen, is actually gay. And you think of all the peculiar pressures that must be on them when they're cast in roles like that and have such a really different private life and have to keep that a secret and have to play the role of great heterosexual lover.
Well, we're now in the area of what Francis Ford Coppola calls one spicy meatball. Rumor and gossip and scandal are, of course, coin of the realm in the movie business. And I take very little stock in it. One would hear all sorts of things, even about the old film stars. You know, you used to hear all kinds of stories about Rudolph Valentino, and you'd hear stories about Wallace Reed, Clara Bow, Mabel Normand, and so on. And, well, it's all apocrypha, so far as I'm concerned. I prefer to deal with hard fact and with research. Listen.
But that's just the thing, isn't it, that if someone was discovered to be gay off the screen, it would be a scandal as opposed to a way of living. Maybe it wouldn't be that much now, but from my understanding, it's still pretty shocking, and everybody's advised to not make anything like that public because it would ruin their
closet.
Careers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that's true?
Well, I've been told that it's true. I don't really know many people or any people. You know, I mean, I don't have Hollywood connections where I know the inside story, but I've been told by authors who've written about Hollywood that's true, and that actors who they've interviewed have been told to just keep to not even to certainly not take a lover of the same sex to the Academy Awards or to any mm-hmm. opening or any place in public where there'd be cameras.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly a most interesting question to be discussing in 1981, almost 1982. obviously, times have indeed changed. There are many political figures in the United States today who are openly gay. They make no bones about it because they don't need to, and they hold high positions in the government. And they simply declare their sexual preference and let it go at that, and it does not seem to damage their careers. I suppose the embarrassment would be if we found, for example, that one of the great macho sexpot leading men was indeed gay off screen. It would be ridiculous to see him play a hot love scene with the leading lady, if we were convinced that in fact he was gay. On the other hand, my beloved and darling friend Noel Coward never in the course of his long life ever made any bones about the fact that he was a homosexual. I don't mean to say that he took ads in Variety, but he simply didn't care, and he assumed that everyone knew that he was. As you say, would he go to the Academy or would he go to... He went everywhere with whoever he wanted to go. And yet, on the screen, he would frequently play a romantic lover. Certainly on the stage in Tonight at 8:30 with his great leading lady, Gertrude Lawrence. And the basic, one of the greatest comedies in the English language is Private Lives. And he played that with enormous success with Gertrude Lawrence, and they played terrific love scenes. And when they did it in England, all England knew, and it didn't seem to affect the play or its impact. So I suppose as time goes by and as we become more and more enlightened and more educated to the fact, I think probably it won't matter. And yet, today it hasn't quite been tested, but I think if it were to be widely known that one of the leading men or leading ladies was gay, I suppose it might have some effect, because there are certain parts of our country which are still living in the dark ages.
You know what I think it is in part? Tell me what you think of this. I mean, actors are expected to act. I mean, you're not supposed to, you don't play yourself when you get before the cameras. You play somebody else. So in that respect, like, your private life or your sexual preference shouldn't really matter. But what would be kind of foolish is for women to buy pinups of homosexual men or men to buy pinups of lesbian women, because that gets a little absurd, and maybe that's where, like, the marketing problems come in if you come out.
Yes, I suppose so. I suppose in terms of fantasizing about someone, you want to believe that somewhere in the nether regions of the imagination, even, that it would be possible to form a liaison. And if you knew, if you were convinced that that person wouldn't be interested in you under any conditions, then it makes the fantasy rather feckless.
I'm talking with Garson Kanin, if you're just joining us, in his new book about Hollywood teams is called Together Again. The other side of that is when there's people who play lovers on the screen who actually become lovers off the screen, and there are a few people like that who you include in your book. And I think the most popular example of that is Bacall and Bogart, who...
Yes, wasn't that interesting? Humphrey Bogart was, of course, an enormously successful, not quite leading man. You see, he went out to Hollywood first to play in Robert E. Sherwood's The Petrified Forest, where he played Duke Mantee, unshaven gangster. And yet before that time, Humphrey Bogart was a rather attractive Broadway leading man who, in fact, appeared with my wife in a play called Saturday's Children by Maxwell Anderson. But he wasn't the originator of the part. He replaced an actor called Roger Pryor. And he was a rather good-looking leading man. But he wasn't starry enough somehow. The charisma wasn't solid enough to get him a Hollywood chance until he played on the stage with Leslie Howard in The Petrified Forest. And he gave such an electrifying performance as this tough gangster killer that when they made the film, they brought him out and they gave him the part. And in those days, in order to get a good part, you had to sign a 7-year contract, and he did. And Warners had him playing those parts, you know, Eddie Robinson gangster parts for a while. And then, very slowly, he began to be involved with the leading lady or the woman, and he became what we would say was a leading man, unconventional leading man, to be sure. And at that time, there was a girl in New York, Betty Bacall, who was acting as an usher. She was an usher at St. James's Theater on 45th Street. And someone noticed her and thought she had an interesting face and gave her a modeling job for Vogue. And she was on the cover of Vogue. And Howard Hawks's wife at that time, known as Slim Hawks, was a reader of Vogue, and she saw this very striking girl, and she convinced her husband to bring the girl out and test her, which he did, and then he put her in a picture with Bogart. And they were instantly fond of each other, although she was much younger than Bogart, and they became an off-screen team and were married and shortly became an on-screen team. And I think that although Humphrey Bogart was not the kind of man who would coach or direct or teach, he, in some subliminal but very important way, brought her out, as one would say. He influenced her. He gave her a little resilience, a little comeback. He was so tough and so hard that it was almost necessary in order to play with him to give him back in kind. And she developed that marvelous veneer, that toughness that has seen her through many, many films with him and without him.
I guess that kind of off-screen relationship sometimes really adds a beautiful chemistry to the film, but if things aren't going well, it can really backfire.
Absolutely, absolutely. In my book, Together Again, Laurence Olivier discusses that very openly. His teaming with the great, incomparable Vivian Leigh, and he says quite frankly that sometimes when things were not going well on stage, it affected their offstage life. And when things were not going well offstage, it affected their onstage life. It's pretty hard to separate. If you're dedicated and if that's your work, that's your life, you can't just, in the way that a bank teller at 5 o'clock closes his window and goes home and doesn't think about banking again until the next morning, you don't do that if you're a creative artist. It stays with you, and you have to carry it around with you. It's your burden, and it's your joy.
You mentioned in the book that it's pretty common for people who work together on screen to end up having a romance, usually that just lasts as long as the filming does. But is there an etiquette that most of the directors and other actors observe when something like that's happening, of maybe ignoring it or looking the other way, or at least not mentioning it outside the set?
Absolutely. I think the ethic is to mind your own business. I think gossip is really the job of gossip writers. But I seldom hear gossip from professionals about other professionals. It's more likely that they'll gossip about critics or newspaper people or radio commentators or television personalities. But they don't gossip about one another. I think sometimes they maybe don't know.
I've seen a few films recently where the gossip columnists have to be physically prevented from entering the set while a film is being made. Has anything like that ever happened to you, where you had to keep them out?
Oh, well, you see, when we talk about what happens in Hollywood, I mean, Together Again is filled with instances of how the teams got together and how they worked and how they survived. But when you talk about Hollywood as a social entity, you have to take into consideration power. Power is what matters. Now, you're making a picture. You've got a director. You've got a producer, a writer. Very seldom does a writer have any power, but let's say the writer. The head of the studio, the executive producer, the person who is representing the money interests, the cameraman. You've got a lot of people on the set. But generally, the power somehow rolls around and it lands in the hands of one person. Now, that person may be the director or the producer, and very frequently, it's the star or both stars. And they're the ones, in the end, who really call the shots. Now, as far as visitors on the set are concerned, suppose I'm making a picture and I'm the director, and Warren Beatty is the star, and the leading lady is Diane Keaton, and the producer is Ray Stark. This is a fictitious setup, of course. And now the press agent calls me, and he says, I want to bring Rona Barrett on the set this afternoon for half an hour. Well, if I've got any brains in my head, and I can assure you that I have, I would say neither yes nor no. I would say, let me find out and call me back in 15 minutes. I would then go to Warren and to Diane, and I would say, they want to bring Rona Barrett on the set. And Warren says, no way. So I call the press agent, and I say, no way. So he calls Ray Stark. And Ray Stark says, well, yeah, I think she should go on the set. He says, but Warren doesn't want her. Well, now you have an instance of where you're going to find out where the power is. Ray Stark may be able to say, now, Warren, mind your own business. I'm going to have Rona Barrett on the set. Warren Beatty might say, if you bring Rona Barrett on the set, I'll go off the set. And that works out one way or another. Tune in next week, and we'll give you the answer. I don't know, in that particular fictitious instance that I've set up, how it would work. But that sort of thing would depend upon who's in charge, who's got the real clout. And it surprises me, for example, to read what I read about the latest Bette Midler picture. Bette Midler is a beloved friend of mine, and I always thought she was a darling pussycat of a girl, but I'm told that she really took charge on this last picture, and people had a hard time getting anything done anyway except the way she wanted it done.
Is that gossip, or do you think that was true?
It sounds quite true to me, from the reports and from the public statements given out by the director, producer, and the other people in the company.
We're unfortunately getting close to being out of time, but I'd like to play a record with Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland singing
"I Wish
You Were in Love Again."
Great teams of all time.
What makes them work for you? as a team?
Well, talent. I suppose when you say Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, I don't think you could go through this list of teams, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. I don't think that pound for pound you could find more talent in any team than in Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. They were as talented young people as ever hit the show business horizon, and I think that's what made them. In addition to which, they adored each other, professionally, I mean. They respected each other. They admired each other. They laughed at each other. They loved working together. And all of these elements are clear when you see them on the screen or when you read about them in Together Again.
Garson Kanin, it's really been such a pleasure to have you here. I really love listening to you tell stories about films. I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh
Air. Thank you, Terry.
Garson Kanin, the screenwriter and film director, stage director, playwright, has written a new book. It's called Together Again, Stories of the Great Hollywood Teams.